Clock Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for May the 6th, 2018, the first Sunday in May. Thanks for joining us as we take our weekly look at the world of politics and policies. We'll take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, I have to tell you, with the weather yesterday, talk about spring is here. I got the grill fired up, made a nice slab of ribs, sat out on the patio, and listened on my phone to the Pittsburgh Stanley Cup playoff game. And then I listened to the Winnipeg broadcast of Winnipeg versus the Predators till I could only make it through the second period, unfortunately. But and I have to tell you, it's kind of neat listening to different voices describing through the radio, describing hockey. And it makes you just appreciate how much John and Troy do here at WGN.
It really does.
Well,
what you have to do without, you know, describing it as it's happening on the radio.
And it's a, you know, it's a, obviously it's a very hard sport to describe.
Yes, it is.
But with the Penguins broadcast, I could never tell what zone the puck was in.
Yeah, Mike Lang's been doing this for a long, long time.
I don't mean to pick on people, yeah. But yeah. But I will tell you that I loved the Winnipeg broadcast, and guess who their lead sponsor is for the Winnipeg Jets?
I have no idea.
Jacuzzi.
Oh.
Jacuzzi Jets. You know, the Jacuzzi hot tub Jets.
Good call.
That's their lead sponsor. So, but they had like a three person broadcast team, which was kind of interesting. Hmm. So, and of course, in the second period, there were six goals scored. I think 4 and 7 minutes at one point, and they actually had to have the third announcer just do the backfill and read off all the scoring plays. So, but yeah, there's something about listening to the sports on radio that I just love.
Yep.
I mean, and sitting out when the weather is beautiful, mm-hmm. It's just great. It's just great. Unfortunately, it'd be better if these teams were winning locally with baseball. My daughter, who is celebrating her birthday today.
Happy birthday.
Kate was down in St. Louis with some of her Missouri friends to cheer on the Cubs as they lost in 10 innings after winning 4-0. And then choking in the 10th inning, 8-6. Those are games you can't afford to lose.
Yeah, especially when your closer hadn't given up a run all year, and in the 9th inning he gave up a couple of runs, Brandon Morrow. And but it goes back further in the game yesterday. I didn't get a chance to see most of it. I was prepping for our pregame at Guaranteed Rate yesterday,
right.
But was watching a little bit out of the corner of my eye. You know, Tyler Chatwood got to stick to that early lead. He had a lot to do with it, too, with the base hit, but he was walking everybody.
Yeah. I mean, he starts an inning by walking the first two batters.
You can't do that.
You know what's going to happen, yeah. Right there. But it's the Cardinals, too. Come on.
Uh-huh.
And the Cardinals aren't that good.
No. And now they've won 4 in a row. They got hot.
They're in first place.
Yeah, they got hot taking on the White Sox.
Yeah, they're in first place. And they're not very good.
Yeah, I agree.
Still very frustrating. And the same on the South side with the Sox and the Twinkies.
Yeah, Hector Santiago had a rough go of it. Again, this is a guy that's normally out of the bullpen and making his second start, not to make excuses
right,
for
right.
him. But again, walks did him in, and he gave up 8 runs in less than 4 innings.
Yeah, and the Twinkies aren't that good.
No, they're struggling too. I mean, they're and part of their problem was the part of the problem that the White Sox had early. They weren't being able to play any games because
right the weather.
Out. Yeah, so they had some issues with that as well because they were the other team there, of course. But I think we talked about this a little bit yesterday on our pregame show as well about what you really have to look for when you're listening to a White Sox game, and it's the bright spots because you want to see some of the young guys.
Right. Absolutely.
So it's almost more. It's really kind of fun to just to kind of zone in and concentrate on some of the younger players. Unfortunately, Moncada now after getting off to a really good start, or not off to a start, but lately he's been playing very well, goes to the disabled list with a hamstring issue. But Tim Anderson last night with a couple of home runs, breaking out of a 1-for-19. And so, I mean, it's there's some reasons to listen. I mean,
absolutely. Future, you know? Absolutely. And I don't disagree. That is the point to listen, because you're going to pinpoint what the future of that team's going to be.
Exactly.
And there is nothing wrong with that. It's just, I could kind of in the back of my head hear Aunt Jo up in Asco, Minnesota, you know, cheering on the Twinkies. And
just ask her how many more wins the Wild had in the playoffs than the Blackhawks.
You have not received an update from up north yet?
I have not received an update. She listens, by the way, so I have a feeling I will hear from her. Okay. I better even turn the dinger off on my phone here.
She may hear something immediately.
Yeah, she may send me one of those texts that Dave's very familiar with seeing.
That we can't read on the
air. Correct.
Just don't give her my number, please.
Why would I throw you under the bus?
I almost threw you under the bus right there.
Actually, I'm sending her your contact info right now.
No.
Well, it'll give you something to read before the pregame.
Good point. Give me
changing my password as we speak.
Oh, man. But, you still, I mean, yeah, the Cubs lost, the Sox lost, but it's spring, it's baseball, it's the weather is sprung, although I guess we're going to be getting some rain here today, but it's a beautiful morning.
Yeah, and tomorrow looks good, too, in the 60s. We're now into the weather that's going to be, that we want, that we need.
Except
rain. When I say we need it, we need it.
Rain later in the week, though.
Yeah. Right.
So.
This will help grass. It will help crops. It will help a lot of things. You have to look at it that way.
Sunshine Schwanee. Right.
Sunshine Schwanee. I made fresh trout on the grill this week.
Ooh.
Look at you.
Roasted potatoes. A very good dinner.
Wow. Very ambitious.
Well, with the Tuesday weather, like I said, you know, earlier, Rick, when we were talking, I was determined to make the best of it. And I did. On Tuesday, especially.
Thanks for the invite. You know, I was in the neighborhood. You know the number. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for thinking of us, you know.
Sure, of course. Yeah. I have to get the grilling down, though. Fish is tricky to do on the grill.
Yeah.
Because you can burn it, you can overcook it. So when I get the act down, I will...
Did you plank it?
No, I didn't. I've got a grill with the grill itself is very small portions on it there. So, the skin is still on the fish, so it is supported. But it's very easy to overcook that.
Well, do you have a grill mat? Use those grill mats.
You could use a grill mat. You can also use these baskets that you can turn
you
enclose
for
the fish.
For the vegetables and
fish.
And
use that for veggies. Yeah, absolutely. Yep, yep.
But when
I get this perfected, then we'll have a party.
Well, I want to help. I want to, you know.
Oh, okay.
You know me.
All right.
I'm always willing
to
help.
You're with the grill? Yes, you are the grill master.
No, I'm not the grill master.
Okay.
It's just...
You're invited.
All right, fair enough. You get the fish, I'll light up the grill.
You're invited.
All right, fair enough.
Andy, you're invited. You're invited.
I'll bring the beer.
Cassara, you're invited.
Boy, I'm ready for breakfast now. Let's get the grill going. Get some nice fresh fish for the grill for breakfast. Old kind of Minnesota camping breakfast.
We had smoked potatoes. Fish for breakfast when one fishing trip my buddies and I did in northern Minnesota. We were up near Tower, Minnesota. You know where that is, Rick?
I know the name of it.
Yeah, Lake Vermilion.
Yes.
Lake Vermilion.
Yep, yep, yep.
That's where we went. Some of the best fishing I have ever done. And one of the buddies brought along a smoker, and we had smoked fish.
Perfect.
It was awesome.
Oh man, I'm hungry.
Me too.
Let's, Andy, work on that, will you?
Yeah. I'm gonna go back home and get my grill.
Yeah, I'm putting you in charge of that. Oh man,
get some bagels in here. We're in business.
Oh, yeah, we need to. I got to talk to Kassira about this. You know, we got to add to her already immense duties that she does for this program, and put her in charge of rounding up the fish for breakfast. I love it. Love it. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Kassira is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. On Twitter, @SymbolSundaySpin. Engineer Bob is out buying some grass seed because of the rain ahead. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for My Name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Rod Joy. He was the Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor on the Chris Kennedy ticket. We'll also speak to Republican State Representative Grant Worley of Naperville. We'll talk to him about Republican opposition to a graduated income tax and whether a budget is likely to emerge from Springfield. And then we'll also speak later in the program to Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton of Villa Park. He's the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and we'll discuss the Rauner administration's task force proposal on rebuilding the Quincy Veterans Home and other news related to the issue of that deadly Legionnaire's disease outbreak that began at the facility in 2015 with subsequent illnesses as a result of Legionnaire's disease. That's all coming up. First, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Time to launch our weekly spin through national politics, and what can you say? From the decisions by the Jesuit priest to rescind his resignation as House chaplain to the antics of a Trump administration that would be a great movie of Charlie Chaplin. Last week, a very wild ride, and let's start out with one of the newest additions to the Trump legal team, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani made a startling admission on Sean Hannity's Fox News show that Trump knew of the hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels and repaid his lawyer for it. Here's Rudy Giuliani.
Having something to do with paying some Stormy Daniels woman $130,000, I mean, which is going to turn out to be perfectly legal. That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation. So
they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Oh, I didn't know that he did.
Yeah.
There's no campaign finance law.
Zero.
So the president...
Just like every... Sean?
So this decision,
Sean,
was made by...
Everybody was nervous about this from the very beginning. I wasn't. I knew how much money Donald Trump put into that campaign. I said, $130,000? He's going to do a couple of checks for $130,000. When I heard Cohen's retainer of $35,000 when he was doing no work for the president, I said, that's how he's repaying. How he's repaying it, with a little profit and a little margin for paying taxes for Michael.
But do you know the president didn't know about this? I believe that's
he didn't know
said.
About the specifics of it, as far as I know. But he did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this, like I take care of things like this for my clients.
Now, of course, the president had denied any knowledge of these payments or Michael Cohen, his lawyer, making the hush money payment. The president apparently wasn't pleased by Giuliani's performance after having previously denied any knowledge of the payments, and he belittled his new star lawyer and defender to reporters. The president denies having changed his story after initially saying he didn't know anything about the hush money.
We're not changing any stories. All I'm telling you is that this country is right now running so smooth, and to be bringing up that kind of crap and to be bringing up witch hunts all the time, that's all you want to talk about. You're going to see, excuse me.
No,
but you have to, excuse me, you take a look at what I said. You go back and take a look. You'll see what I said.
You said no.
Excuse me. You go take a look at what we said. But This is a witch hunt like nobody's ever seen before. And what they should do is look at the other side, where terribly bad things have happened, where terribly bad things have been done.
So as the AP reporter that was questioning him pointed out, he said no when she asked him about the payments. Now he's not changing any stories except he knew about the payments. And according to his new star lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, not only did he know about the payments, but he was serving to reimburse the lawyer for them through the retainer plus a profit, none of which reported in campaign finance documents. This is where things may get troublesome. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We were talking a little bit about Rudy Giuliani emerging as this new Donald Trump spokesman on the Stormy Daniels issue. And Trump says that Rudy Giuliani's right when it comes to combating the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, but he probably should do a little bit more research on the hush money.
He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight. He's a great guy. But what he does is he feels it's a very bad thing for our country, and he happens to be right.
So he's got to get his facts straight. But that didn't stop Rudy Giuliani from going back on Fox News last night and on the Judge Jeanine Pirro show. And instead of cleaning up the issue of the hush money, he basically doubled down on it.
The end result is real simple. That's all we're interested in. The President of the United States did not in any way violate the campaign finance law. Every campaign finance expert, Republican and Democrat, will tell you that if it was for another purpose other than just campaigns, and even if it was for campaign purposes, if it was to save his family, to save embarrassment, it's not a campaign donation. And second, even if it was a campaign donation, the president reimbursed it fully with a payment of $35,000 a month that paid for that and other expenses. No need to go beyond that. Case over. That case should be dismissed by the Southern District of New York.
Now, Rudy Giuliani's a lawyer, and he says he knows campaign finance law because he once ran for president. Of course, we all know how that worked out. But he doesn't know campaign finance law. One, this expense was never reported on campaign finance disclosure documents. So when he uses the term expenditure, that's a legal term. It's an expenditure is listed in federal FEC reports. Two, you can't reimburse someone for a campaign contribution. That's not allowed. That's to prevent the skirting of campaign disclosure laws by having people give money in someone else's name. That's campaign finance 101. Plus, $130,000 far exceeds the campaign contribution limits that are permitted under law. So, Rudy Giuliani, as the president said, may have some more studying that he needs to do. Well, joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Rod Joy. Most recently, the Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate on the Chris Kennedy ticket. Rod, welcome, as always, to the Sunday Spin.
Thanks for having me back.
I wanted to have you on because I want to now that you've had a bit of time to kind of
decompress
yes. and you know it, because I give, obviously I'm critical of politicians, but I give them a lot of credit because it's a lot of work and people don't appreciate having to be on all the time and, you know, thoughtful about what you're saying all the time and trying to give off positive vibes in meeting people and those kinds of things and doing it in five different cities every day. It's a tremendous amount of work, and being able to turn things off after a losing effort has just got to be a difficult thing.
Well, I'm proud of the race that we ran. Obviously, I'm disappointed in the outcome. But to run statewide, to run alongside Chris Kennedy, was truly a privilege. It was a challenge, an opportunity of a lifetime. It reinforced some core beliefs. The first is that we live in a beautiful state. You mentioned traveling to five cities in a single day. You know, we traveled up and down Illinois. We had an opportunity to meet with and listen to voters of all colors, all creeds, and from all walks of life. We have a beautiful state. You know, there's a lot to love about Illinois. You know, our colleges and universities are internationally renowned. Our cultural institutions are second to none. You know, we're blessed with millions of acres of fertile farmland, great businesses, great people, and so many wonderful assets. But it also was eye-opening to see the amount of human suffering that's happening in our state. You know, I feel like I've learned a whole hell of a lot.
What are your takeaways?
Well, I think some of them, you know, for me, the campaign was a powerful platform to heal and to learn and to grow. I felt like that was the same thing for Chris. You know, I saw him evolve as a candidate. You know, who he was as a candidate on that WTTW debate stage for the last debate was a vastly different candidate than who he was when he first announced. I also learned some brutal lessons about how power works in this state and in the city. I learned about what grabs headlines. I learned a lot about all of the political players, those who take risks, those who only take orders, and everyone in between. You know, I feel like in many ways, Chris helped drive the narrative of this last election cycle. I think he really helped shine a light on and lift up some of the urgent issues facing our state. And, you know, I think we take a little bit of pride in the fact that we will have a new assessor in Cook County. You know, certainly lifted up our broken local property tax system and how that's taxing people, pricing people out of their homes. We had an opportunity to lift up issues of racial justice and racial equity, and to have the editorial boards of both major newspapers write about racial equity is something I'm proud of. We help shine a light on the rising tide of violence and gun violence in particular in our state. I think we help champion the need for a progressive income tax in Illinois, and not just a progressive income tax, but a way to get after achieving the effect of progressivity without opening up the state constitution. I'm eager to build upon those hard-fought lessons learned as I think about the next chapter, but I'm truly proud and honored to have had that opportunity.
I know that you, I mean, obviously one of the major issues that came out of that campaign was Chris Kennedy's assertion that Rahm Emanuel was leading basically a effort, a strategic effort to have poor and people of color leave the city. And through programs and those kinds of things, which prompted, you know, a lot of attention. It also prompted some criticism. And I know that you've talked about media coverage and,
yes,
and with that as an example.
Yes.
And talked about it critically.
Well,
which I'm welcome to hear.
That was a viral moment. You know, we can get into the specifics of what Chris said and how people responded to it. But one thing that I don't think people fully appreciate is Chris had been giving voice to those issues. Essentially, he was making the case that and really connecting the dots between Bruce Rauner and Bruce Rauner's friend and former business partner, Rahm Emanuel, and the fact that under Bruce Rauner's leadership, the state of Illinois was getting smaller and wealthier. And under Rahm's leadership, the city of Chicago was getting smaller and whiter. Now, he had been saying these things, lifting up these issues from day one on the campaign. And Chris was of the mind that the media would pay closer attention to these issues after the new year, that when we entered 2018, the media attention on the campaign would intensify. And sure enough, I think it was on June 3rd,
January, excuse me.
Yes. January
3rd. It was a long campaign. Yeah,
on January 3rd, we had a press event, and that's when the media really picked up on the message of people being pushed out of the city of Chicago.
But you say connected the dots. And indeed, he had talked about those kinds of themes earlier, but this was the first time that he laid blame directly at Rahm Emanuel.
I don't think it was the first time. It was the first time that the media paid attention to it. You know, we've had events, large and small, where he asked him
about these issues, but then he never directly laid blame until that point on the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, I think.
You were with him every day, day in and day out,
and I think people reacted to the messenger and his motives. You really can't argue with the facts or the outcomes. You know, the city of Chicago has lost a quarter of a million black folks over the last 10 years. If you look at what's happening, you know, literally pick an agency, any agency in our city, the police department, where there's a brutal report released by the Department of Justice that showed instead of serving and protecting, in many ways, the police department was systemically abusing and neglecting people of color in the city, where the city has shelled out hundreds of millions of dollars in brutality and wrongful and misconduct cases. You look at the Laquan McDonald shooting murder, where a 17-year-old young man was shot 16 times. You look at the schools where this mayor had the single largest school closing in U.S. history in 2013 and closed neighborhood schools in predominantly neighborhoods of color. You look at the water department where there is blatant racism at the water department. You look at what's happening with the assessor's office, where the assessor's office under Joe Berrios' leadership was a Robin Hood scheme where he was literally robbing the hood of resources. And we had a mayor who oversaw all of this. And, you know, personally, that issue is something that hits home for our family. You know, we experienced what's brutal and ugly and vicious about this city. We have options. I spent the entire last summer thinking about this notion of the Great Migration, where black families move to Chicago, seeking opportunity, seeking safety, seeking a better life, and now the Great Exodus, where particularly black families who have choices, who have options, are often voting with their feet by moving away. And I think about this notion of the place, the places that we call home, and what it means to live free, and to live free from fear, and to live with dignity, and to live with respect, and where you can raise your family. And what's happening in Chicago, and what Chris Kennedy called out, was an obvious but apparently inconvenient truth about the racial implications of public policy.
And I want to ask you, given those thoughts, about what's next for you. But first, we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Rod Joy. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. We're speaking with Rod Joy. He was the Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate on Chris Kennedy's ticket. Before that, you were Executive Director of Change Illinois. Certainly, as you've explained, you want to see some change, and you want to see some change at the top. Where does that fit in as far as you and running for mayor?
Well, I certainly think Chicago must change. I think we can and we must do better. I think we need a new vision for our city, a proactive, affirmative vision where we're all connected, where we all count, and where we rise and fall together. I'm going to fight hard to bring that vision into sharper focus. I also am really eager to organize. You know, Chicago is the birthplace of community organizing, made famous by the likes of Saul Alinsky, Jane Addams, Harold Washington, Lou Palmer, and so many others. One of the frustrations of the last election cycle was I really didn't get an opportunity to organize like I wanted to. I'm eager to build a movement in this city that's multiracial, multi-generational, multi-ethnic, a true rainbow coalition that's fighting for civic and social change. And I want to get more people involved in civic life. I was a big fan of the late, great Abner Mikva, and his motto was democracy is a verb. It's not something we have, it's something we do. And I'm committed to encouraging more and more Chicagoans to do democracy. We have 9 months and 20 some odd days until the February 2019 election. This is an opportunity for us to decide as Chicagoans, are we going to be subjects or are we going to be citizens? And I want to go about the business of encouraging the art of civic engagement. I'm looking for a candidate. You know, our family has been through a lot over the last 10 months. My wife, Alana, gave me permission to participate on the last campaign to run for office. Whatever we do next will be a family decision. But to be honest with you, I'm really looking for a candidate who has the right values, someone who has the right vision, someone who can unite Chicagoans, because I think that's the big issue facing our city.
Have you seen that candidate?
I think I've met with candidates who have declared, and I've quite frankly met with some candidates who are about to declare. I also have been making the case that Chris Kennedy has been essentially keeping residence in the city of Chicago since January. You know, our campaign headquarters were here, so I'm excited about what's coming. And I look forward to making an announcement about what's next in the very near future.
So you're still looking at it?
Yes, I'm still looking at it.
And but as you said, when you were a candidate for lieutenant governor, you weren't able to organize in the way you wanted to. Is that because of the duties of a candidate that it kind of prevents that kind of grassroots organizing?
I guess there were a couple of things. One is I joined a campaign in the middle of a campaign that was well underway.
Right.
I think the other piece is, in many ways, there's great potential to rally around a progressive candidate and a progressive cause. For the primary election, we had Senator Biss seeking to run to our left, and we spent a lot of time bickering about who's the most progressive
right.
ticket. You know, what's the most progressive ticket? I think there's an opportunity in front of us in Chicago where a lot of the groups that for whatever reason sat out the gubernatorial primary or weren't with us to engage them in a more meaningful way. And that's something that I'm incredibly excited about.
So September is, I believe, filing for mayor.
Yes.
So
imagine how much is going to happen between now and September.
What time frame?
I think by the end of this week, I will have made a decision about how I plan to participate in the municipal election.
So where's the news conference going to be?
Oh, you're hilarious. How about this? I'm sure we'll be keeping each other posted.
All right, fair enough. Well, as long as you keep bringing the donuts.
Listen, I bring the donuts every time.
Yes,
I usually try to bring those gourmet ones with bacon on top, but I just had to bring the D&D today.
There's nothing wrong with Dunkin' Donuts.
Yes.
We appreciate it. Rajoy, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
It's great to be back in the fishbowl. I'm going to miss this place, man.
Well.
And I have one request.
Yes.
Instead of fighting about the sign on the Tribune Tower,
mm-hmm.
I would like to propose that we take down the sign a short distance from here, the Trump sign, and keep up the Tribune sign.
That sounds like something a mayor might want to try to do. Yes, I'm just saying. Yes.
We could unite everybody there. Yeah. Yeah.
Rod Joy, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue is Representative Grant Worley, a Republican from Naperville. It's on various committees, appropriations for higher education, labor and commerce, personnel and pensions. I would love to talk to you about pensions, but that could eat up a little bit. We'll see if we get there. But one of the things, Representative, thank you for joining me this morning.
Rick, thanks for having me this morning.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the issue of a graduated income tax. Now, granted, it would take a constitutional amendment to do it. I don't think the votes are there for it. The votes haven't been there in the past for it. Uncertainty about issues of rate structure, those kinds of things. But it was a dominant theme in the Democratic campaign for governor. All of the major candidates support a graduated income tax. Questions about whether the state's current flat tax basically exacerbates issues of income inequality. Republicans are adamantly against it. There are some Democrats that are against it as well. I wanted to get your thoughts on the issue of a graduated income tax.
Certainly. Well, once again, thanks for having me today. There is bipartisan opposition to it. The process that we have for budgeting in Springfield is actually backwards. So instead of going to the taxpayers and asking for more money up front, perhaps we go back and do what every other state, local unit of government does and start with a budget process and then as a line of last resort, then go ask the taxpayers for more dollars. Now, the progressive, some people call it a fair tax. To me, this is just a little bit more of identity politics. It's the us versus them. They have it. We want it. Let's take it. Instead, I would suggest that Springfield follow the process that's not only outlined in our Constitution, but has proven to be successful elsewhere in units of government. Let's do the hard work first and not do the easy part of just simply raising taxes. So there is bipartisan opposition to it. You mentioned the constitutional requirements to get there. It's the soonest we can put it on the ballot is 2020. And we'll, you know, let's put it to the voters and see what happens. But if we're going to do that, if we're going to open up the Constitution, let's open it all up. So let's talk about the pension protection clause. Let's look at the entire Constitution and not just cherry pick things that are politically expedient for some.
So let's have a con-con?
I wouldn't be opposed to that. Let's look at it all. Let's put everything on the table and decide what is best to move our state forward. Our state's fiscal condition, as we all know, is beyond crisis, and we need hard solutions. So we can't cut our way out of this, and we can't tax our way out of this. It's going to be a combination, but I'm not going to go to the taxpayers and ask for money until I've shown the work, until I've earned their trust, which is something that's severely lacking in Springfield, to ask for more money. Let's get the efficiencies in government and make our case for more revenue and earn that trust back.
Well, let's talk about budget then. And I mean, I know there's been a line about, you know, this is a setup for a tax increase, although it's an election year. I mean, everybody agrees, for example, on both sides about this state needs a capital plan, but nobody wants to talk about the dedicated revenue funding source that is normally associated with that because that would require some dedicated source of revenue, normally some kind of a tax increase or a new tax on something.
So once again, let's come up with a plan in a bipartisan way. And I agree that 2018, because it's an election year, is basically a lost year in Illinois finances. And we can't afford a lost year financially. It's time value of money. We're not paying our bills. We need to come up with that plan. But due to the election cycle, I don't hold a lot of hope out for some bipartisan solution. And it's going to take a long-term solution. 10 years. But that will also require fiscal discipline, which is something that the state of Illinois has never, ever had.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing when I hear that term fiscal discipline because, no, it's never happened. It never happened.
It's our only way out of this. We can't continue to keep doing the things that we've been doing and expect a different outcome. We need changes. We need reforms. Yes,
well,
there's that R word.
Every outside group that's looked at that, you know, Civic Committee, Commercial Club, whatever, they're all, you know, you have to have a plan and you have to stick with it. And it's going to take a long time.
Correct. And so, you know, here we are. I go back down to Springfield tomorrow. We're 3 weeks from the end of session. And what are we going to see? It's going to be the same as before. Same as it ever was. We'll continue to, you know, try to talk about a budget, but we'll see that Speaker will drop a budget with probably less than a day left in session, which is what he's done every year since I've been there. And that's no way to govern. That is budgeting for failure. It doesn't have the solutions that we need in the state. It's simply what one man wants and how we can get through the election cycle, which is why we are in such a fiscal morass.
We're speaking with Republican Representative Grant Worley from Naperville. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune inside the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower. Joining me here in studio is Republican Representative Grant Worley from Naperville. We're talking about issues involving finances, and of course, we all know what a miserable situation the state of Illinois is with its finances. We're talking about the issue of a graduated tax, and we've got a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick. So, Representative, you mentioned a budget, and you said that the state should do like other states do. But applying that same thinking, wouldn't you think that we should do like other states? Illinois is only one of eight states that doesn't have some form of a progressive tax. The federal tax is based more on a progressive tax. But again, 42 states, and particularly do the same. Look, I'm not getting about it. I don't really want to pay any more taxes, but particularly look at this tax cut, and we are seeing where more of the wealthier, higher income people are benefiting from it. So just, you know, tell me, why would you be against some form of progressive income tax?
Thank you, Ron.
Well, Ron, thanks for that question. Just because other states are doing it doesn't mean that Illinois should follow suit, because if we're going to start looking at what other states do, you know, down in Springfield, we hear a lot about Minnesota and the great ideas and how their progressive budgets are working, but we're not looking at what they're actually doing at the policy level to get there. When we're talking about prevailing wage, they have a lower prevailing wage and a lower prevailing wage job size. So looking at what other states do, first and foremost, I think Illinois has to get its budget in order, and it has to be done in an open and transparent manner. Then we can go and look at what other states and budget for success. There are many budgets out there that we could boilerplate over and bring into Illinois, but then we have to also get the underlying policy issues that align with that to get us to where Illinois needs to be in comparative to other states.
So where does growth come in as a factor?
Well, we absolutely need growth. The only way we're going to get out of this morass is with growth. And, you know, on the House floor, we see almost on a daily basis policies that are put forward that impinge growth in Illinois. Or we can't get rid of programs that are not favorable to business. We, you know, just a couple weeks ago, we had fiscal notes, for example, put on a couple of bills, and the majority party just rules those inapplicable, which, first off, it's crazy because they are clearly applicable if it's a pension bill or something like that, but that's just how the game is played.
And it's become an ever-increasing game.
It is.
And an example of that is the issue of taking the politics out of the drawing of district boundaries. And as I've said before, this was a unique feature in the 1970 Constitution when the drafters believed that the prospect of Republicans and Democrats not agreeing on a map was the penalty would be, it would be decided by the flip of a coin or a name out of a hat, all by chance, and it'd be winner take all. And that would be so horrifying, that prospect, that Republicans and Democrats would be forced to work together on a map. Doesn't it work that way?
It has not, and we've actually seen that coin toss before. So fair maps would go a long way to help solve a lot of Illinois' problems. It would put us less at the partisan divide. It would bring us together. It would allow representation fairly across the entire state. If you want to talk about ideas that we should take from other states, I'll go to Iowa on this one. They have a computer-generated map. It's fair. There's no complaining about it. You know, you look at some of these districts that go from here in the South Loop all the way down to Kankakee, it's ridiculous. People in Kankakee and Chicago have very little in common. Why should they have their representative or their state senator representing them equally in Springfield? Fair maps go a long way to solve a lot of our problems.
And I would argue, I know the governor is a constant supporter of term limits. Term limits, the courts have pretty much ruled that term limits can't be done as a petition-driven kind of thing, so that it would have to emanate from the legislature, and we know that's not going to happen. But I would argue that there seems to be a growing support, at least stated support, on both sides to come up with a way to try to keep the politics, in many respects, and the game of having politicians pick their voters and bring that to an end. And if you had some fairness in the map making, that would alleviate some of the issues involving term limits.
Wholeheartedly agree. It's one of those things that there is bipartisan support. Everybody's, you know, thinks it's a good idea, except for maybe a handful of individuals that have an immense amount of power in Springfield that they derive their power from how the map is drawn and drawing that map. So until and unless that changes, I don't hold out a lot of hope. But it polls extremely high around the state. People want fair maps. People want their government back. They want us working on behalf of them, and we should be.
I mean, I actually go back to the days of cumulative voting in this state, which I found to be a much more representative form of government in the state, where you had minority representation in every district, a minority party representation in every district.
Hindsight, looking back on the cutback amendment under, Pat Quinn had a lot to do with that.
That may not
have been such a great idea in hindsight. Now, do we want, that many more representatives running around? I don't know if that's such a good thing, but the concept of how we vote and you get fair and balanced viewpoints from Chicago to Naperville to Cairo, that would be a good thing for our state government.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the door is closed on adding 59 members to the Illinois House.
I will not be running that legislation.
So let's go back to the budget issue. Do you think we're going to have a budget, just at least of any kind of framework budget?
So first and foremost, I think we need to come up with a budget fix for our current fiscal year. I don't know where that stands in the process. So we need to look in arrears and fix where we are now. But this is an election year. I don't think anybody wants to end May without a budget on either side of the aisle. It would just be more political ammunition. So hopefully there's enough mutually assured destruction here that we can come up with at least a solid one-year budget that balances. We should start with a revenue estimate. The Illinois Constitution says we should start with how much money we have that we're currently bringing in and go from there. I remain an optimist. For as much time as I've spent in Springfield, I still remain an optimist. We can get this done. We can solve these problems, but it's going to take us putting down the weapons and picking up our pencils and going to work.
And we're going to have to make a pension payment.
We are.
And that's a significant chunk of money.
And without a plan, that only gets worse. Even with a plan, that only gets worse, and we have to come up with a plan to solve that long term.
You mentioned about, just going back to pensions very quickly, about opening up the Constitution and that pension protection clause. And, I mean, there's a great argument that by some that could only be prospective, not affect current benefits.
I agree with that. The Illinois Supreme Court has been pretty clear on that. And then, ex post facto, you can't change something going in arrears. But even on a go-forward basis, that would help loosen up some of the restrictions if they're implemented and we find out they're not working. Once it's given, it can't be taken back under the current law. If we try something and it doesn't work and we need to pull that back, we would then have the ability. So I agree that it would be on a prospective basis only, but that is still a tool in the toolbox that we don't currently have.
But it wouldn't really affect our current situation.
Indeed, it would not, but it would certainly help us on a go-forward basis with whatever we decide to do as a solution if it doesn't work.
What do we do about the current situation?
We're going to have to find a way to fund it or go bankrupt. Those are our two choices. Bankruptcy for the state is currently not an option. There are many that think we're already fiscally insolvent and technically bankrupt. We're one notch away from junk bond status. If we don't have a budget, we will be junk bond status. So it's either time to come up with solutions or try to figure out how we get out of this in a legal maneuver like Detroit or other areas that haven't been successful. I mean, Harvey is the canary in the coal mine. You see what's going on there, and it is not pretty, and it's state intervention. is basically what we have there. The comptroller's withholding dollars that should be going to something else to make the pension payments.
Do you favor bankruptcy as an option?
I think it should be a position of last resort. But if we can't make it ends meet, there's only so much taxes we can raise. We could tax everybody 100% at some point in time, and it might not be enough to pay for our fiscal obligations. So something's going to have to give. What does that look like? I'm married to a teacher. Respect what they do. It's a great profession. But I try to tell my friends that are teachers that are farther than 10 years out, you might want to look at some alternative investments, because I don't know if you're going to get 90 cents on the dollar, 20 cents on the dollar, or 100 cents on the dollar right now. Without a plan, without a budget going forward, I don't know what that looks like. So you better be saving on your own, because the state might not be able to make its obligations.
And on that cheery note, Representative Grant Worley, Republican from Naperville, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I know we've tired of political advertising from the recent primary elections, but there's elections going on all around the country all the time. In Georgia, Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp is running for governor. He's got a new ad in which he holds a shotgun on his lap, pointed at a youth named Jake, as he explains the rules for dating his daughter.
I'm Brian Kemp. This is Jake, a young man interested in one of my daughters.
Yes, sir.
Jake asked why I was running for governor. I said, one,
cap government spending.
Two,
take a chainsaw to regulations.
Three,
make Georgia number one for small business.
And two things if you're going to date one of my daughters.
Respect.
And?
A healthy appreciation for the Second Amendment, sir.
We're going to get along just fine.
Brian Kemp for governor.
That click was the closing of the shotgun, by the way. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, voters in West Virginia are going to the polls to pick a Republican challenger to Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Manchin. It's a three-way race, and one of the candidates, Don Blankenship, is in a war with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Blankenship has been insulting McConnell's family, including the background of his wife, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao.
Hi, I'm Don Blankenship, candidate for U.S. Senate, and I approve this message.
Swamp Captain Mitch McConnell has created millions of jobs for China people. While doing so, Mitch has gotten rich. In fact, his China family has given him tens of millions of dollars. Mitch's swamp people are now running false negative ads against me. They are also childishly calling me despicable and mentally ill. The war to drain the swamp and create jobs for West Virginia people has begun. I will beat Joe Manchin and ditch Cocaine Mitch for the sake of the kids.
So, for the record, Chao's parents moved to the United States from Taiwan nearly 60 years ago. They launched a shipping company in New York. Also for the record, Blankenship was the former CEO of Massey Energy. And in 2015, he was convicted of conspiring to violate mine safety standards in connection with a 2010 mine explosion that killed 29 miners. He was convicted and spent a year in federal prison. Now he's a candidate for the United States Senate. Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Senator Tom Cullerton, Democrat from Villa Park, Chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you, Rick. I appreciate being here. That was an interesting introduction.
Well, you never get to hear these ads. You know, most people never get to hear these things, and it's a good opportunity for people to hear what's going on in politics.
That is true.
Around the country.
That is true.
I wanted to have you on the show because of various news issues related to the Quincy Veterans Home, and
right.
That's the facility, post-Civil War facility, that in 2015, deadly outbreak of Legionnaires' disease, 13 deaths, dozens were taken ill, and we've had annual outbreaks since then. Governor's office, the administration has task force report released proposing rebuilding the facility, totally redoing the water system there, $245 million.
Right.
I guess part of me was when I saw this report, it was like, I think everybody knew that this was going to have to happen.
Right. Well, I think everybody agrees. Look, for 3 years, the CDC has said reports that they needed to replace the pipes, and they've never tried to replace the pipes. We had a report in 2016 that the governor's administration hid that would have showed what it cost from the brick engineering firm that showed what it would have cost to actually fix the pipes. 2015, there was actually only 12 deaths, and over about 55-plus people had gotten sick. Then, in, you know, the governor's administration tried to replace a water treatment facility, but not replacing the pipes, the actual pipes that the CDC has recommended three times to replace, and they never did it. Then we had more illnesses right after they put in a new water treatment facility.
$6 million.
$6 million water treatment facility. And then governor declared everything was fine. Then go a year later, water heats up, Legionella in the pipes again. And that's when we had another death. So that brought our death total to 13. And this was in 2017. And we got that final report. So I called for a special audit. And we've been pushing ever since for the governor's team to come forward. Subsequently, we've had emails that were heavily redacted to me showing what their responses were. But other news sources over at WBZ, Dave McKinney and Tony Arnold, had found... you know, had got the Adams County Public Health Department to actually give them foiable emails that were unredacted and showed that the entire response to the crisis was how to spin it and how to make it so that they wouldn't be responsible for it, to the point you even saw the most recent email come out where Darlene Sanger, who's running for comptroller and was deputy governor, tried to blame the whole thing on Tammy Duckworth. So this has been a catastrophe since day one, and the governor has truly failed on this entire issue. And now we're going to look to get the money to put it together and build a new home, like they probably should have done in the first place, or at least followed the recommendations that the CDC did, and also get the brick report done back in 2016.
Well, I think one of the most concerning things about the CDC findings were basically that the pipe system, that it was going to, there was no way you could eradicate it without, short of getting rid of it.
The pipe system has always been in the CDC reports, and it's never been fixed. You could add a new water treatment facility
but you're still using those pipes.
But it's still the pipes going underground. It's still the pipes going into the buildings. And now they've put these incredibly expensive taps or filters right after the tap. And if you hear in our last hearing, they'll say we've had no reported cases since they started putting those in, and they tout that as a success. Those have only been in a month. But if you go before the tap and you test the water, they've been able to see Legionnaires or Legionella in there. So the filter is keeping it out for right now. But how long will that go? Because they've had filters on before, and we've still had illnesses. They just had illnesses in February there.
Well, and even going further in this, and as mentioning the filter, in some of these reports are the fact that because of the sediment and
right,
the age of these pipes, that those filters, which were supposed to last maybe a month,
right,
they're being replaced in literally days.
Right. Because they have to, because they don't have a grip on it. They don't have control of it. They just submitted the report on Tuesday. We had asked for it the previous Friday, but they gave it to us on Tuesday. And now we're in the process of working to get the money for it. But at the end of the day, the one good thing about this is this facility can get 65% federal funding, which is why, in our respect, we continue to ask the president, look, there's no director of VA Affairs or Veterans Affairs for the U.S. government. Our director of Veterans Affairs has like 8 to 10 days left in her job. So the governor needs to call the president of the United States and say, we need expedited funding. President Trump came out about, I don't know, a few weeks ago, said he was going to spend close to $1 billion on veterans homes. Our governor needs to call and say, I need that 65% payback, and I need that 65% of funding, because here's what's going on at the veterans home in Quincy, Illinois. And sadly, we've been asking the governor to do that for a couple weeks now, and we are not getting any backing that he'll actually make that phone call.
We're speaking to Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton from Villa Park. He's chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, joined by Democratic State Senator Tom Cullerton from Villa Park, Chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, and we're talking about the Quincy Veterans Home. And, you know, I just think I'm not sure the importance of this issue has resonated here in the Chicago area, is that it's more of, it's been a downstate story, despite the fact, as you mentioned, the great work that the folks at WBEZ have done in exposing kind of this whole timeline scenario of what's going on down there. But now there is a proposal out there. Are we going to move forward with that?
Yes, we are going to move forward with that, and we're going to do everything we can to get all the money that is necessary. But again, figure that 85 to 86 million of that proposal will come from state resources, but 160 million has to come from the federal government through the Veterans Administration there, and that is why we need the governor to make the phone call. He needs to call the president and get that money. Now, I don't think he will. He's avoided the president at every opportunity he can. So the fact is he needs to suck it up and go talk to the president and say this is expedited, this is necessary, this is needed. I think part of the reason that in Chicago people may not have thought about it, or up here they may not have thought about it, because in Chicago they're still dealing with the fact that the governor cut off the money and delayed the Northwest Side Veterans Home by 2 years. So that has had expedited costs, that has gone through the roof, and that should have been open a year and a half ago. But remember, in 2014, he got elected. First day in office in 2015, he stops paying out all expenses. All grant money is gone. That stopped the Veterans Home on the northwest side of Chicago. And you've heard the alderman down here in Chicago continually say, this is ridiculous. Senator John Mulroe, whose district it's in, for 2 years have had to watch a building with only one wall up and complain over and over and over to the governor, why have you stopped the Veterans Home in Chicago? And now we have 3 years of mismanagement and absolutely lack of any desire to fix anything correctly in Quincy and do Band-Aids, when in 2016 there was a report that was shelved and hidden from the General Assembly.
When you've held joint hearings mm-hmm. on this repeatedly, but the administration, when they do appear,
right,
they're not being forthcoming.
No, not at all. I mean, the great thing about the press is the fact that the press is literally fact-checking every time they say something at a hearing. But every time we've had a hearing, they've done something. Right before we had the January hearing, all of a sudden the hospital within Quincy itself, Blessing Hospital, came out and said, oh, we can do Legionnaires testing within 24 hours.
Which that had been a recommendation.
Had been a recommendation from the CDC.
Or had been a problem that CDC cited.
And truthfully, our director of public health could have said to do it in 24 hours. Springfield's an hour 45 away. They could have very easily been doing the testing, which right after the first hearing, they said, oh, we're going to be testing at the Department of Public Health office in Springfield. That's another thing. CDC, 3 years of reports, and they wait till we hold a hearing on why they've mismanaged and why they're failing at this entire process. So the fact is, it's just the amount of errors. If it wasn't amazingly egregious and horribly, I mean, you're talking about veterans who are dying. And they just haven't been able to do anything to fix it. And their play is, well, we stopped more veterans from getting sick. In my estimation, no, you actually made more veterans get sick. And we're still going through this. And to have a plan now 3.5 years after the first occurrence, and to have a plan after all these recommendations from the CDC, should not be something to pat yourself on the back with, especially since you hit a report a year earlier. You're talking August of 2016. There was a report out on how to fix it, and they shoved it in a drawer and didn't want to do it.
So do you appropriate the state share?
So what we'll do is,
I mean,
we'll get...
In absentia of what the feds...
We're going to get everything they need. And then we're going to tell the, and the governor has to call the president of the United States. We need a letter from the president that says, after speaking with your governor, I am going to expedite that $160 million that you need because it's important that our veterans stop dying. And it's important that our veterans and their families stop getting sick. And if the governor can't make that phone call, then I don't know what else to say. I mean, that's a phone call. Look, they're both Republicans. They should be able to make that phone call very easy. Chris Christie called Obama, and Chris Christie did not like Barack Obama at all. He didn't like the President Obama at all. But when the devastation occurred in his state, he made a phone call to President Obama and asked President Obama to come see New Jersey and ask for help to fix. Our president should have the same courage and the same opportunity to get this accomplished.
So, but what I'm wondering is, do you appropriate $245 million?
That'll be the goal.
And then have,
that'll be the goal.
And hopefully there's the federal reimbursement.
The goal will be to put that in there.
As a whole block.
Get that in there and see what the governor does. His initial appropriation in his budget was $50 million. We're now going to have to find a way to appropriate $245 million because he had only said in his budget address that he came out in January, he said, I'm going to fix everything for $50 million. If you remember that, he said, I'm going to get $50 million for the veterans home. We're going to get it fixed and done. Now, all of a sudden, I'm going to need $245 million. The governor's doing everything he can. He's scrambling. And let's remember, his deals with buying and selling buildings, if you recall last year, they could have bought a building in Springfield for $700,000. Instead, what they did is they did a five-year lease at $500,000 a year, and made some local people down in Springfield a lot of money instead of buying that building for $700,000 to literally hold papers. That's what the building's doing. They signed a five-year lease for $500,000 a year. And that audit report is coming out in August.
Stay tuned for more audits. State Senator Tom Cullerton, Democrat from Villa Park, Chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, thank you.
I appreciate the press and the media staying on top of this issue because this is an incredibly important issue.
Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you.